History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Germany's Luftwaffe had risen to incredible heights by 1941. It pummeled Western Europe, pushed Great Britain to the closest point of surrender it would have in the entire war, and laid whole cities in waste. The Luftwaffe was led by Hermann Göring, a World War I flying ace and a narcissist, who managed to perfectly complement the Wehrmacht in the beginning of the war. One of the keys to its success was the revolutionary parachute light infantry, or the Fallschirmjäger. It seized key objectives in Scandinavia and the Low Countries in the spring of 1940 and helped speed the advance of Germany's tank forces, while at the same time, dive bombers caused the surrender of stubborn nations with their bombing of European cities that defied Hitler. But in the same year, 1941, the fortunes of the Luftwaffe soured after Britain successfully evacuated Dunkirk in France and its soldiers weren't captured, and the ensuing Battle of Britain, when air forces bombed repeatedly cities in Great Britain, but Great Britain didn't surrender. Göring wanted to restore his fortunes and shift the momentum of war in his favor again. He thought that the prestige of the Luftwaffe had fallen and wanted to bring it back up. Even though the Luftwaffe wasn't successful against the British Royal Air Force, he hoped that his paratroopers would remain undefeated. He turned his eyes south to the Mediterranean. Nazi forces surged in the Balkans in 1941 after Benito Mussolini failed in his invasion of Greece. Lieutenant General Alexander Luhr, the commanding general of the Luftwaffe's 4th Air Fleet, and Major General Kurt Student, who was the commander of the 11th Air Corps, presented their plans to invade Crete, which would be conducted only by Luftwaffe paratroopers. Göring loved the idea. An airborne invasion of Crete would restore him to Hitler's good graces. Göring thought that his airborne corps could conquer the strategic island with little or no assistance from the Wehrmacht and show how independently powerful his group was. The idea for today's episode came from listener Salvador Sanchez, and he asks this: I was wondering in the Second World War, why did Hitler or the German general staff stop using the Fallschirmjäger for strategic jumps after Crete? And we'll explain later what happens there. Yeah, some small units of commandos jump behind the Allied lines during the Battle of the Bulge, but why not any more parachute and glider operations? Especially after the success they had in Norway, Eben, and the Netherlands, what led to the stop, and do you think if they would have used them more during the battles on the Eastern or Western Front, could it have made any difference? Well, that's an interesting question about World War II and a what-if scenario, but I want to take this question and look at it in relation to lots of other things. First off, the origin of the paratrooper, and really the origin of people jumping out of planes and parachutes, and originally hot air balloons. Using a parachute to safely descend to Earth goes back to the late 1700s, and all the way back to Benjamin Franklin, you have world leaders excited about the possibilities of what this could mean. They thought it would completely revolutionize combat, reconnaissance, and unique ways to attack your enemy in three dimensions. Now, the possibilities weren't realized for over 100 years until the 20th century because hot air balloons weren't that great at maneuvering. You couldn't really have controlled flight. Planes were far too rickety in World War I to do much. You were lucky if a pilot would survive a flight, let alone a plane that would be large enough to carry enough men to parachute. But by the 1930s, planes are large enough and steady enough that you can bring enough paratroopers and you can weave them into your overall strategy. This also happens with the evolution of warfare of a combined arms assault, meaning you're not just using your infantry at one time and your air forces at another time, but they're all attacking at one time in a combined arms assault to deliver maximum damage to an enemy. And with this paradigm shift of warfare, paratroopers are critical in that. Then we'll look at the assault on Crete itself and the legacy of the Fallschirmjägers, how they launched a daring rescue operation of Benito Mussolini, and the unique role that paratroopers have today. So let's wheel back and first talk about what paratroopers were used for. For Germany to plan on conquering Crete just with his paratroopers was not a conventional way to understand how they were used. Paratroopers are always part of a larger strategy of combined arms, Combined arms, it's an approach to war where you integrate different combat arms of a military. For example, using infantry and armor in an urban environment where one supports the other or both support each other. Military strategist William Lind distinguished combined arms from the concept of supporting arms like this. Combined arms hits the enemy with two or more arms simultaneously in such a manner that the actions he must take to defend himself for one make him more vulnerable to the other. In contrast, supporting arms is hitting the enemy with two or more arms in sequence, or, if simultaneously, then in such combination that the actions the enemy must take to defend himself for one also defends himself from the other. An example with paratroopers, if you've watched Band of Brothers, which follows the 101st Airborne Division as they land on the beaches of Normandy before the D-Day invasion and then go overland through the Battle of the Bulge up to the end of World War II, shows you exactly what this looks like. The paratroopers land in Normandy before D-Day, and they're essentially attacking Germany from the rear with combined arms so that Germany can't just focus on the beaches, the infantry there, the tanks there, but they have to focus in multiple directions. This tactic of combined arms isn't ancient. It began in the First World War, and it was a way to break through the gridlock on the trenches. Early in the Western Front, fighting descended into trench warfare where two sides were literally dug in and couldn't move. The generals applied conventional military thinking, where tactics consisted of heavy artillery barrages, then somebody blows the whistle, and then there's a massive frontal assault against well-entrenched enemies. This is how supporting arms was used. But the tactics never worked, there was huge loss of life, but little move on each side. But combined arms develops throughout the war, and it's first called all-arms battle. This included direct close artillery fire support for attacking soldiers, whether air support or mutual support of tanks and infantry. At the Battle of Cambrai, in which the British used tanks, artillery, infantry, and small arms and air power, they were able to break through the enemy lines. Previously, a battle like this would have lasted months, with hundreds of thousands of casualties. But through the use of combined arms and coordinated planning, the tactics used in the 100 Days Offensive allowed Allied forces to exploit breakthroughs in enemy trenches in 1918, which eventually led to the surrender of the Central Powers. So military strategists realized that battle now involved many more moving pieces, and you couldn't have a blunt object attacking in a trench line anymore. Combined arms was a fundamental part of operational doctrines in World War II, which the German Blitzkrieg utilized, which is based on combining tanks, mobile units like mechanized infantry or cavalry, and infantry, which were supported by artillery. So that's what combined arms is. Now, let's go back even further and look at the first time a parachute was utilized. And I'm always amazed at situations like this, of somebody who is the first to do something where, if you don't do it correctly, you're going to die. Like the first astronaut to go on a suborbital flight around Earth. The first person to jump out of a height high enough that if his parachute doesn't deploy successfully, he will most likely die. So let's take a look at that. The idea of parachutes go back to the 15th century, and there was a model tested in 1617, but you really couldn't use them because there was no vessel that could fly. You could jump off of a tall building, but very few buildings at the time of the Renaissance and the early modern period were more than a few stories high. I did mention in an earlier podcast episode about counterintuitive knowledge about the Middle Ages and science of the Middle Ages that there was a monk in the 12th century in England who flew on a glider, but that didn't have nearly enough altitude for a parachute to come into play at all. But with the invention of the manned hot air balloon, everything changed. Benjamin Franklin envisioned the possibilities, but also the dangers of an airborne attack after the first manned flight in a hot air balloon. He said, 5,000 balloons, capable of raising two men each, would not cost more than five ships of the line. And where is the prince who can afford so to cover his country with troops for its defense, as that 10,000 men descending from the clouds might not in many places do an infinite deal of mischief before a force could be brought together to repel them? There was a fear that troops could drop from hot air balloons as rapidly as if a flock of birds ascended on you, and there's no way that you could marshal your forces quickly enough. Benjamin Franklin, who was part of the Continental War effort, knew when he had to deal with Continental regular troops, it was really hard to muster them quickly to any sort of battle, and he feared what an airborne strike force like this could do. Well, he had nothing to worry about because hot air balloons weren't nearly that practical. But let's take a look at the person who actually invented the first parachute and was able to use it. And that was André Jacques Gamarin, who lived from 1769 to 1823. He was a French aeronaut and the first person to use a parachute regularly and successfully. He perfected it and made jumps from greater altitudes than anyone had done before. He first had the idea of using air resistance to slow somebody's fall from a high altitude when he was a prisoner during the French Revolution. He never used a parachute to escape from the high ramparts of a prison where he spent 3 years, but he remained interested in the idea of a parachute. In 1797, he completed his first parachute, which was a canopy 23 feet in diameter and attached to a basket with suspension lines. On October 22, 1797, Gamarin attached the parachute to a hydrogen balloon and ascended to an altitude of 3,200 feet. He then clambered into a basket and severed the parachute from the balloon. He failed to include an air vent at the top of the prototype, so Gamarin turned wildly in his descent, and that's why there's a vent there so that you go down straight. But he landed unhurt half a mile from the balloon's takeoff site, even though he was shaken. In 1799, Gamarin's wife, Jeanne Genevieve, became the first female parachutist. In 1802, Gamarin made a jump from 8,000 feet during an exhibition in England. He died in a balloon accident in 1823 while preparing to test a new parachute, but he at least proved the proof of concept. You have to wait almost a century before parachutes become anything approaching practical. The one who created our modern parachutes was Gleb Kotelnikov, the person who made the first modem backpack parachute. In 1911, the 39-year-old, who was a Russian actor turned inventor, wanted to create a better parachute after watching a stunt pilot fall to his death from an airplane aerobatic display near St. Petersburg. The 1910s was the period where airplanes are moving from the rickety Wright brothers contraptions into something that is still very rickety, very dangerous, but military strategists are starting to see the potentials of airplanes. Kotelnikov was rattled by the spectacle, and he devoted much of the rest of his life to design life-saving devices. Kotelnikov's invention changed everything. His backpack parachute could deploy successfully even when the user pulled a ripcord after leaping from a moving cockpit. If the parachute were already deployed before you wanted to use it, it would catch air and at best wouldn't do anything to save your life, and at worst could drag you out of the airplane. But his backpack parachute solved all those problems. He applied for a patent in France and was granted the patent, which summarized the function of his parachute. The working principle of the apparatus is as follows. In case of an emergency, a pilot, wearing it on his back, could throw himself out of an aircraft, opening a knapsack by pulling a cord attached to its lock. In case of an unexpected fall, the device can work quite automatically. For that purpose, the lock on the parapack is connected with a carriage of an aircraft by means of a cord, which would open the lock of a parapack, being stretched under the weight of a falling man. Well, people saw the potential of the backpack parachute immediately, especially as nations entered World War I. Some military visionaries saw them as a way to break the deadlock of trench warfare. In 1917, Winston Churchill proposed forming entire regiments of infantry that could be dropped by aircraft behind enemy lines and end the stalemate on the Western Front. Others had that idea as well. The head of the U.S. Army Air Service in the First World War, Billy Mitchell, wanted to equip elements of the American 1st Infantry Division with parachutes and drop them from bombers near Meritz, France, as part of a combined arms offensive against the German lines. But the war ended before this could be carried out. But that didn't stop planners from envisioning what to do in the next war. They envisioned armies of what they called sky soldiers being carried by dozens or even hundreds of biplanes. And you can almost imagine them grabbing onto the wings of the plane. This is what these strategists are thinking, which is about all you could hope for in the 1910s and early 1920s. When the target area would be reached, the soldiers would slide off the wings when their parachutes would deploy, and they'd fall to the ground ready for battle. The plan for such an operation was slated for February 1919, but the war ended 3 months before that. Now, there's another important invention in the 1920s that actually makes paratroopers and paratrooping a practical enterprise. Holding onto a wing simply won't do it. The first effective means of supporting mass infantry airborne operations came with the development of the static line parachute, invented in Italy in the 1920s. The difference between this and the older backpack parachute is that parachutes are attached to the inside of the aircraft and deployed automatically on departure. This could allow jumps to happen at lower altitudes because you can deploy your parachute much faster. And this is important because you want to drop as low as possible because this limits exposure to enemy fire and also provides a tighter drop zone grouping. So that way, soldiers aren't pulling their lines all over the place and dropping hundreds of meters or even miles away from each other. A static line is a cord attached at one end of the aircraft and at the other end to the top of the jumper's D-bag, which means the deployment bag where the canopy's packed. The parachutes fall from the aircraft cause the static line to become taut, which pulls the D-bag out of the container on the jumper's back. The static line and the D-bag stay with the aircraft as the jumper leaves, and it's pulled back into the aircraft by the dispatcher. The canopy can now inflate, and the jumper continues to fall. So the jumper drags the parachute behind him, causing the upward rushing wind to force open and inflate the canopy. The canopy inflates and begins supporting the jumper within only 4 seconds. That's why you can fly so low to the ground or as low as possible. With this invention, armies around the world began organizing their own specially designed paratroop units, especially as cargo planes grow in size. Now cargo planes are large enough that they can hold a number of paratroopers, and people were discarding the idea of paratroopers holding onto wings or anything like that. The first paratroop drop was by Italy in 1927. Within a few years, several battalions had been raised and formed into 2 divisions. These would later fight with distinction in World War II, but the divisions were never used as paratroopers. Men drawn from the Italian parachute forces were dropped into special force operations in North Africa in 1943. But it was the Soviet Union that first showed the military possibilities of airborne infantry in the 1930s. They were experimenting with the idea and planning to drop entire units complete with vehicles and light tanks. To help train jumpers, parachute clubs were organized with the aims of transferring them into the armed forces. The Soviet military led a series of maneuvers in 1935 and 1936. The early experiments were crude because the paratroopers had to exit their slow-moving transporters through a hatch in the roof and then position themselves along the wings and jump together. But the exercise managed to land 1,000 troops through airborne drops, followed by another 2,500 with heavy equipment delivered via air landings. Other nations observed these maneuvers, including Germany. In 1936, Major F.W. Emons ordered to set up a parachute school at Stendal and was allocated a number of aircraft to train on. The military had already purchased large numbers of Junkers aircraft, which were modified for use as parachute transports. The first training happened on May 3rd, 1936. Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. Other nations observed the proceedings, including Japan and Italy, and they followed Russia's lead and pioneered their own airborne forces. Great Britain, France, and the U.S. followed suit. By the end of the decade, nearly every large industrialized nation had their own paratroop unit, and as World War II was all but certain to break out, many believed that if a conflict did break out between the major powers, then paratroopers would be a critical part of the action. And they were. The nation to lead the charge of paratroopers in World War II was Germany. They became the first nation to drop infantry into combat. History's first wartime jumps happened in the 1940 invasions of Norway and Denmark. Now, before I talk too much about the Fallschirmjäger, I think it's worth it to take a little pause and look at what exactly a paratrooper was carrying. Paratroopers carried a lot of equipment. If you watch Band of Brothers, to refer to that again, it shows that the members of Easy Company, the company that was part of the 101st Airborne Division, before they drop into Normandy prior to D-Day, they're sitting on the runway and they're sitting on the ground with a huge pack on their back and someone has to help them up to be able to stand up. That's because paratroopers carried an average of 70 pounds of equipment and officers averaged 90 pounds of gear. If you include the parachute, men weighed in at 90 to 120 pounds over their body weight before they were dropped. This is because they were dropped in unknown territory and had to be prepared for any encounter they had. So if we look at Allied paratroopers, here's what they took. This is what a standard parachutist took. In his pack, he had a M1 Garand rifle with an 8-round clip, a cartridge belt with a canteen, hand grenades, a parachute and pack, anti-flash headgear and gloves, a pocket compass, a machete, a .45 caliber Colt automatic pistol, flares, and a message book. For an officer, and in this case it's a British officer, but it's similar to an American officer, You'd also have a Sten gun, a spare magazine with 9mm ammunition, 2 pounds of plastic high explosives, pocket hand grenades, 2 full belts of Vickers, wire cutters, radio batteries, basic equipment webbing, 48 hours worth of rations, water, and a cooking and washing kit. Spread throughout your pockets, you'd have a loaded 45 automatic pistol, a medical kit, an escape or survival kit, a toggle rope, and additional personal items. For emergency rations, a paratrooper would have 4 pieces of chewing gum, 2 bouillon cubes, 2 Nescafe instant coffees, and 2 sugar cubes and creamers, 4 Hershey bars, 1 pack of Charms candy, a pack of pipe tobacco, a bottle of water purification tablets to purify water, and you use them. You put 2 tablets in a canteen full of water, about a quart, and shake briskly, wait 30 minutes before drinking water. So that's what would be on your person, and you were heavily packed. Now let's get back to the Fallschirmjäger. Throughout World War II, the Fallschirmjäger commander was Kurt Student. Their first attack occurred during the Norwegian campaign, when the Fallschirmjäger captured the defended airbase of Sola. The Fallschirmjäger also had their first defeat at this time when a company was dropped in the village and railroad junction of Donbass on April 14, 1940, and they were destroyed by the Norwegian army in a 5-day battle. On May 10th of that year, the Fallschirmjäger performed a raid on the powerful fortification Eben Emael. It had multiple gun emplacements and had 1,200 Belgian troops manning it. The airborne troops attacked the artillery casements and pillboxes using flamethrowers, demolition charges, and hollow charge grenades. It really showed their elite status as troops. The mission was accomplished by the assault group Granite, which had only 85 soldiers. Even though they were at a firepower numerical disadvantage, the airborne troops took control of the fort after only a few hours of fighting. During the invasion of the Netherlands, 2,000 troops of the 7th Air Division were deployed, while approximately 12,000 troops of the 22nd Air Landing Division also participated. Now let's come to the German invasion of Crete, which was the final major German offensive action of the Greece campaign in May 1941. Crete was located 60 miles from the southernmost tip of mainland Greece. It's 160 miles east to west and 12 to 30 miles north to south. Most of the farmland is near the shores. Then there are fertile belts, and then they rise up to volcanic mountains that soar up to more than 8,000 feet. Crete was large, and it could accommodate multiple airfields. Its size was enormous if you compare it to islands in the Pacific, where Allied forces set up airfields there. And there was a natural harbor at Ceuta Bay that could shelter a number of vessels. Warfare History Network has a good breakdown of how Germany planned this invasion, and it begins with Student's plan for invading Crete, where he wanted to make simultaneous drops at 7 key objectives on the northern coast of the island and then reinforce bridgeheads while separate groups linked up with each other. But other leaders wanted to concentrate the entire invasion on the western end of Crete, where the Malim airfield and the port of Ceuta were located, and then march east to capture the rest of the island. Student would command 22,000 troops, all of whom participated in the invasion, either in the initial attack or as reinforcements. Student's 11th Air Corps comprised the 7th Airborne Division, as well as the 5th Mountain Division, commanded by Brigadier General Julius Ringel. The latter replaced the 22nd Air Landing Division, which had been detached to guard the Romanian oil fields. This plan called for 750 troops drawn from the Parachute Division to land by glider, then nearly 10,000 to land by parachute, and 5,000 to land on captured airfields, and 7,000 to arrive by sea. There weren't enough transport aircraft to draw off all these parachuters at once, so 2 shuttles would be necessary. The first wave would land shortly after daybreak, and the second wave by mid-afternoon. The first would focus on capturing Malim Airfield, then capture the capital city of Konya and the port of Ceuta, while the second wave would concentrate on taking the Rethymno and Heraklion airfields. On May 14th, the units of the 7th Air Division had reported the 7 airfields from which they would be flown to Crete. The following day, battalion and regimental commanders were briefed by Student at his headquarters in Athens. Although the glider landings and paratroop drops originally were scheduled for May 17th, there was a delay in transporting 5,000 tons of aviation fuel by tanker through the Adriatic Sea. So Student had to postpone the attack until May 20th. The Germans had also failed to accurately estimate the size of the enemy force on Crete, despite regular reconnaissance flights. Student didn't know until the final hours leading up to the invasion that the Allied force on Crete was 4 times larger than the previous estimate of 10,000 troops. That's because when mainland Greece fell to the Germans in April, 18,000 soldiers, Allied soldiers, went to Crete, where they were joined by 12,000 fresh troops from Egypt. These Allied units were integrated, in theory, when 12,000 Greek troops divided into 8 regiments, giving a total troop strength of about 42,000. Sir Archibald Wavell, the commander-in-chief of the British Middle East Command, flew to Crete on April 30th and replaced General Maitland Wilson with Major General Bernard Freyberg, commander of the New Zealand Division, who'd fought under Wilson in the Greek mainland. Winston Churchill sent Wavell a message that made it clear the Allies wouldn't give up the island without a fight. "It ought to be a fine opportunity for killing the parachute troops," Churchill wrote. "The island must be stubbornly defended." When the Allied troops evacuated from Greece, they abandoned nearly all their vehicles and heavy weapons. On Crete, their arsenal consisted of 49 field guns, 8 3.7-inch howitzers, and 22 tanks. They had basically no air cover. Any aircraft that could still fly had returned to Egypt. Positions around the island were unfortified, and most units didn't have radios. The Greeks were armed with antiquated rifles and had as little as 3 rounds of ammunition each. But the British had several advantages that might help or even stall or repel the Nazi invaders. They controlled the seas and could intercept any German reinforcements or supplies arriving by boat. The Allies would have more men on the ground during the first day of battle than the Germans could drop from the sky. Thanks to their code-breaking Operation Ultra, Freyberg knew shortly after he arrived that the Germans were planning a massive airborne operation intended to capture the 3 major airfields on the northern coast of Crete at Heraklion, Redamo, and Malim. British intelligence believed, mistakenly, that the Germans might storm the beaches in the Malim sector with the help of the Italian Navy, but the Germans didn't want to mount any sort of beach assault like that. Well, the invasion began on May 20th in the pre-dawn darkness. The elite paratroopers of the German 7th Air Division boarded the transports and gliders at 7 captured Greek airfields for the flight to Crete. 15 men boarded the 502 Junkers, while another 750 men climbed aboard gliders that would take them to the ground, fully outfitted to assault anti-aircraft batteries and various installations. At 4:30 a.m., the first of the heavily laden planes bounced down the makeshift runways in southern Greece. After daybreak, the Luftwaffe began a series of bombing runs in preparation for the airborne assault. Hearing the drone of bombers overhead, Allied troops raced for cover. They huddled in trenches as bombs explode over them, sending shrapnel slicing through the air. Hundreds of medium bombers were used to soften up targets for the first wave of the airborne assault. As soon as the bombers turned back, dive bombers and Messerschmitts raced in seeking targets. The smoke and dust from the bombing had hardly cleared before Allied infantry stationed around the airfield spotted the gliders carrying elements of the storm regiment. One string of bombers touched down just outside the barbed wire from Lieutenant Colonel Andrews' 22nd New Zealand Battalion. Then, transport planes flew over the coastline and began releasing small specks into the sky that people could see were parachutes being deployed. Their colors were white, red, green, and yellow. The paratroopers floated to the ground under white parachutes, while chutes in other colors showed that they were weapons canisters or supplies or weapons. The landscape erupted into a firefight. The New Zealanders blasted away at the gliders, killing many of the assault troops before they had a chance to exit the aircraft. One of the first casualties was Major Franz Braun, commander of the 3rd Glider Detachment. Despite the loss, the paratroopers attacked and captured the Tavernites Bridge. Troops on both sides scrambled for cover and good fighting positions. The capture of Malim Airfield was the sole responsibility of the 4 Battalion Storm Regiment, which would arrive by glider and parachutes. The Germans had plotted a 3-pronged attack to capture Malim. One group of paratroopers would land west of the Tavernites River, then another would land east of the airfield around the coast road, and a third would land on what was dubbed Hill 107 south of the airfield. 2/3 of the gliders, which formed a strike force known as Task Force Comet, were ordered to seize key objectives located near Malim Airfield. The men from the task force were drawn from Major Walter Koch's 1st Battalion of the Stored Regiment. The gliders of the 1st Glider Detachment landed near the mouth of the Tavernites River. The paratroopers were able to overwhelm the gun crews that were armed with only pistols. They then advanced on the northern perimeter of the airfield, but then found themselves pinned down by soldiers of Company C of the 22nd New Zealand. While trying to disengage and retreat to German lines along the Tavernites, Wolfgang Plessen, who led the 1st Glider Detachment, was struck and killed by enemy fire. The gliders of Koch's group and the headquarters of the Storm Regiment's 1st Battalion swooped down on Hill 107. 15 gliders under Koch angled for the southwestern slope of the hill, while another 15 gliders touched down on the northeast slope. The glider in which Koch was seated clipped a stone wall and then spun around and split in half. He suffered a severe head wound during the landing, but Koch still took personal control of the situation, dispatching runners to instruct the paratroopers on his side of the hill to assemble near the wreckage of his glider. Like the two other glider groups that landed near Malim, Koch's paratroopers took heavy fire from the New Zealanders. The losses in Koch's group were so severe that only 25 paratroopers of the 150 who landed on the southwest side of the hill gathered with Koch in an attempt to storm the hill. But the attack was broken up as soon as it launched. Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. The other three battalions of the Storm Regiment were to drop by parachute along the coast farther away from the Malim airfield and secure the approaches to the airfield. The 2nd and 4th battalions of the Storm Regiment dropped west of the Tavernites. These paratroopers reached the ground and found their weapon canisters and formed into cohesive units. The battalions included two heavy weapons companies armed with mountain howitzers and anti-tank guns. But after sizing up the tactical situation and realizing that Koch's detachment was in danger, two companies from the 2nd Battalion were dispatched on a wide march to the south in hopes of capturing Hill 107 from the rear. The unluckiest group of Germans in the Malim sector was the Storm Regiment's 3rd Battalion that was led by Major Otto Scherber. Instead of dropping his men onto the beaches as planned, the pilots released them onto the short hills beyond the coast road, where they were shot up by the 21st and 23rd New Zealand battalions. A New Zealand officer wrote, "They were right on top of us. Around me, rifles were cracking. I had a Tommy gun and it was just like duck shooting." Some of the paratroopers managed to cut their way through friendly fire forces along the Tavernites, while others simply took up defensive positions to await rescue. When the fighting tapered off after a nightfall in the Malim sector, Freyberg wired Cairo. He said, "The margin by which we hold them is a bare one, and it would be wrong of me to paint an optimistic picture." After midnight, Andrew issued orders for the 22nd Battalion to fall back to the east. He lacked radio communication with his companies, so he sent runners to alert the forward companies to withdraw and begin moving east with companies A and B. His decision was catastrophic to the Allied defense. By retreating from Malim, he turned over the airfield to the Germans. By 5 a.m., the entire battalion was marching toward ground occupied by other units of the 5th New Zealand Brigade. Not knowing that the 22nd New Zealand Battalion had abandoned Malim, the Germans feared that a British counterattack the following morning might solidify the Allied hold on Malim and drive the Germans beyond the Tavernites River. Word filtered up to German high command that evening of a possible debacle on Crete. The first day's losses, which were found to exceed 1,800, shocked the German commanders. Under growing pressure to abort the invasion, Student racked his brain for a way to be able to turn the battle around. He worked under the assumption that it would be possible to begin landing transports at Malim on the second day, so he ordered 600 reserve paratroopers bound for Heraklion to reinforce the Storm Regiment at Malim, and he instructed Rengel to prepare the first wave of mountain troops to fly to Malim that afternoon. Transports began to land in the morning at 8 o'clock on the 21st with supplies and ammunition, but the mountain troops wouldn't arrive till the afternoon. Student ordered four more companies of paratroopers dropped in the sector that afternoon. Two companies dropped safely on the west of the airfield, but the others landed to the east of the airfield and they were badly mauled by the 20th New Zealand. The reserve force braced itself to receive the German attack. The Germans were now landing troops directly on the airfield, so Freyberg ordered the 20th Battalion, the 4th New Zealand, and the 23rd Battalion, the 5th New Zealand, to retake Malim airfield. Because the attack involved a complicated reshuffling of troops, the Allied attack didn't begin until 3 a.m. on May 22nd. They had less than 3 hours until daylight, and the New Zealanders advanced along the coast road. The 20th New Zealand moved toward the airfield north of the coast road, while the Maoris advanced south of the road. New Zealanders quickly became bogged down in house-to-house fighting from small groups of paratroopers which had been reinforced. By dawn, the Allied force was still short of the airstrip and under attack by Luftwaffe fighters and bombers. The Allies broke off their attack that afternoon. Something that really changed the momentum of Germany's attempted conquest at Crete was the Royal Navy getting involved on the night of May 21st. They repulsed two lightly protected German convoys that were bound for Crete. The first convoy had 2,330 men on it and was attacked by a task force made up of three cruisers and four destroyers. Most of the Germans were rescued from the water, but their vessels were loaded with weapons and equipment, and those were sunk. Another task force that had four cruisers and four destroyers intercepted a larger convoy with 5,000 troops bound for Heraklion less than 12 hours later, and they forced it to return to the Greek mainland. German transports, despite the shelling, were landing at a rate of 20 per hour when Allied units were exhausted and running short on ammo. After its unsuccessful counterattack, the 5th New Zealand withdrew east the morning of May 23rd. Malim became fully operational for Germans, and ME-109s began operating from the Malim airport. The next day, the Germans drove the Allies back onto a series of hills known as Galatos. When the sun rose on May 25th, five resupplied German battalions faced two New Zealand battalions low on ammo. Throughout the morning, the Germans pounded the Allied positions with heavy artillery and mortar in preparation for the assault. At noon, they advanced across the ground. In the fighting that afternoon, Brigadier General Hermann Rahmke's paratroopers overran D Company, 18th Battalion, and the battalion's other three companies fell back to reorganize. By late afternoon, a steady stream of Allied soldiers were flowing into the rear. With the withdrawal from Galatos, the last Allied hopes of stopping the German offensive and keeping the island failed. The New Zealand Division, along with two Australian battalions, had no choice but to fall back on Kinnear. The next morning, Freyberg informed Wavell that the Allies were losing the battle because the number of fresh German troops arriving daily and the constant harassment by German fighters and bombers were wearing them down. He wrote, "No matter what decision is taken by the commanders-in-chief, from a military point of view, our position is hopeless." Freyberg radioed Wavell on May 27th that the garrison must be evacuated before it was destroyed. Wavell informed Churchill of the situation, and the Prime Minister gave his permission for the British Navy to remove Allied ground forces from harm's way. Wavell suggested that Freyberg retreat east toward Heraklion, but Freyberg planned a fighting withdrawal through the mountains to a small fishing village on the southern coast. From there, troops on the western sector would be evacuated and moved to Alexandria, Egypt. But the reserve force was once again pounded by Germans. German mortars began landing at 8:30 a.m. Soon, men on the battle line heard a huge amount of fire in their rear. With a continuing influx of reinforcements, Ringel had reorganized his forces into five regimental-sized battle groups. Rahmke and the 100th Mountain tied down the reserve's front, while the 3rd Parachute swung behind, catching it in a pincher move. Ringel ordered the 85th 141st Mountain Regiment to tramp east towards Suda Bay. So the Germans quickly annihilated the reserve force. The front line evaporated, and the British soldiers were reduced to fighting in small isolated groups. One-fifth of the 1,250-man force managed to escape. The rest were captured or killed. By the time the reserve force was annihilated, the Allied forces in western Crete were in full retreat. As soon as Churchill approved the request to withdraw the Crete garrison, the British Navy went into action. Since the deepwater port at Heraklion could accommodate large ships, Wavell and Admiral Sir Andrew Brown Cunningham, the commander-in-chief of the Mediterranean station, withdrew Chapel's men immediately. On the night of May 28th, the Royal Navy loaded 3,500 men onto two cruisers and the destroyer escorts in order to take them back to Alexandria, Egypt. The force protecting the Retimo airfield had no option for evacuation. They lacked a deepwater harbor, and Campbell had to decide whether to try to cut his way towards Sfakion or to surrender. He chose to stay at the airfield in the hope that the Royal Navy would find a way to evacuate his troops. The German force that arrived in the town of Retimo on May 29th outnumbered and outgunned its foes. They had artillery, anti-tank weapons, and mortars. And the Germans had offloaded tanks at Castelli, a seaside village, which had joined Whitman's command. The Germans called on the Allies to surrender. Campbell surrendered along with 700 men, but some retreated into the hills where they held out for several months until a submarine picked them up. The evacuation from Sfakion was carried out over a four-day period from May 28th to May 31st. The task force assigned to the evacuation sailed to Sfakion for the last time on the evening of May 31st. 4,000 troops were carried to Alexandria that night, with ships that left at 3 a.m., but many Allied troops were left behind. On June 1st, Lieutenant Colonel Theo Walker surrendered 5,000 Allied troops to an Austrian officer of the 100th Mountain. The Royal Navy transported a total of about 16,000 Allied troops to Egypt. The Germans had driven the garrison from the island and captured its three airfields intact, but they suffered major casualties. Their assault force numbered 22,000 paratroopers and air landing troops, and the Germans recorded nearly 6,500 casualties, including 3,500 killed or missing in action. Half of the losses happened on the first day, most among the paratroopers of the 7th Air Division. The Allied forces, excluding the Greeks, had about 3,500 casualties, including 1,700 killed. 12,000 British and Anzac troops were taken prisoner. The Greeks weren't evacuated, so the roughly 10,000 who survived the battle also went into captivity. So, why did the Allies lose a battle, and what was the result of the battle? And if the paratroopers won the battle, why weren't they continually used in the war, as the original questioner asked? Well, going back to the Warfare History Network article, their analysis is that the Allies lost the battle because of miscommunication and miscalculations at headquarters. Freyberg had the resources at hand to defeat the Germans if he would have taken initiative during the first few days of battle. But he didn't commit his reserves in the Canet-Souda sector to keep Malim airfield out of German hands. Freyberg was focused on the idea that Germans planned a simultaneous beach assault, and he withheld reinforcements from the main battle. The Allied forces still fought very hard, and Freyberg's ability to conduct a fighting retreat allowed the Royal Navy to extract more than 16,000 soldiers, nearly two divisions of infantry. For Kurt Student, leader of the German paratroopers, the triumph at Crete was mixed. It was bittersweet. He saw his beloved 7th Parachute Division mutilated, but the days of large-scale German parachute drops were over as a result of Crete. Hitler summoned Student and other senior parachute commanders to his headquarters on July 19th. After congratulating them and presenting them with a Knight's Cross, Hitler conferred separately with Student, and he stunned him by telling him that from then on, paratroopers would play a less active airborne role in the war. Hitler said, "Of course you know, General, we shall never do another airborne operation. Crete proved that the days of the parachute troops are over." Well, that might have been true for the Nazis, or at least the role that paratroopers would play. But with the landing of the Allied paratroopers in Normandy 3 years later, that would prove Hitler wrong. The Fallschirmjäger suffered other losses during the Battle of Crete. The Germans used 22,000 airborne soldiers, but in only 9 days, 3,200 of them were killed or missing, with another 3,400 wounded. So Hitler was horrified at these losses, and it was said that he no longer sanctioned large-scale airborne operations. Well, that wasn't the end of the Fallschirmjäger in World War II. Although they weren't used in large-scale operations, they did well in commando raids. The most famous is the rescue of Italian Prime Minister Benito Mussolini, the Gran Sasso raid. Here's what happened. On the night between July 24th and 25th in 1943, after the Allied invasion of Sicily and the bombing of Rome, the Grand Council of Fascism voted a motion of no confidence against Mussolini. The king replaced him with Marshal Pietro Badoglio and had him arrested. Hitler ordered different military organizations in Germany to track Mussolini and ordered the paratrooper and ordered Kurt Student to execute the liberation, to rescue him. Mussolini was being held at the Tyrrhenian Mussolini was being held around Tyrrhenian Sea Islands by his captors. Eventually it was determined that Mussolini was being imprisoned in Gran Sasso, a remote and defendable mountain plateau, which was built a hotel linked with a cable car. On September 12, 1943, an operation was led by Otto Skorzeny, an SS commando, and 16 SS troopers, who joined the Fallschirmjäger to rescue Mussolini in a high-risk glider mission. 10 gliders, each carrying 9 soldiers and a pilot, towed by planes, started between 105 and 110 from the Pratica de Mare Air Base near Rome. Skorzeny's SS troopers sat in the 4th and 5th glider. The units landed, and the valley station of the Funicular Railway, leading to where Mussolini was held, was captured at 2 o'clock in a ground attack by 2 paratrooper companies. They also cut all telephone lines. At 2:05, the airborne commandos landed their 10 gliders on the mountain near the hotel. One crashed, causing injuries. The Fallschirmjäger and Skorzeny special troopers overwhelmed Mussolini's captors. These were 200 well-equipped guards, without a single shot being fired. This is also due to General Fernando Siletti of the Italian African Police, who flew in with Skorzeny, told the troops to stand down. Skorzeny attacked the radio operator and his equipment and stormed into the hotel, followed by the SS troopers and paratroopers. Only 10 minutes after the beginning of the raid, Mussolini left the hotel, accompanied by the German soldiers. Mussolini was evacuated. He was eventually taken to Vienna, where Mussolini stayed overnight at the Hotel Imperial. The next day, he was flown to Munich, and on September 14th, he met Hitler at the Führer headquarters Wolfslayer in Rostenburg. The operation was acclaimed, even though there was little enemy resistance. Only 2 enemy soldiers died. Otto Skorzeny and his 26 SS soldiers took much of the credit for the success of the operation, even though 82 Fallschirmjäger soldiers played a more significant role during it. Skorzeny received a promotion and was awarded the Knight's Cross of the Iron Cross, and considered to be for a while the most dangerous man in Europe. So, to get to the conclusion of this episode, paratroopers as seen in World War II weren't useful when they were the main fighting force. But when they were used in a combined arms assault or for surgical strikes, they could be highly effective. This is a story about the evolution of warfare, how military strategists learned to use these different fighting units and put them into different pieces together. And keep in mind, in World War II, a lot of these fighting units are brand new. A tank corps is a new thing. In World War I, it was used as part of the infantry. Or take air forces. They were more of a sideshow in World War I, but a core part of World War II. And one could argue that the whole point of D-Day was for the Allies to gain air supremacy so they could successfully cross into France and give enough supplies to the troops fighting there. Paratroopers as well. They were a new thing in World War II, the first war where they were widely used, and as their use came to be understood better and better over the decades, they found a very important part in combined arms warfare. There you have it. That is all for today's episode. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our Spymasters include Bill Ivey, Moondoggy from Ohio, Tom from Ohio, Ryan Gillen, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael from New York, Carl from Norway, Josh Reddick, Jennifer French Lee, Jay Carrington, McCrays, Salvador Sanchez, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraser. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a 3-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.